It must be through the real pleasure of pleasing to do these things. So Confucius pointed out that the thing to do was to forget the problem of getting better. And in his school, which he ran for a number of years after he retired from public life, Confucius simply forgot all about making people better. Rather, he taught them to enjoy themselves doing good things. He taught them to enjoy writing good poetry. He taught them to enjoy riding horseback well. He gave them opportunity to share in music, in art, in artistry, and in drama. He sat with them and played musical instruments, and they sang together, and they enjoyed it. There was no emphasis whatever upon being better. There was merely the realization that if you were a Chinese gentleman, you enjoyed good poetry. And so, being desirous of being a gentleman, certainly, you enjoyed good poetry. At first, perhaps you knew nothing about it, but gradually, through familiarity, you did learn something. Then you studied the classics. There was no talk about being better. You were simply being exposed to culture. You were being exposed to value. You were gradually developing new standards of taste. These standards of taste you accepted because they were associated with the people you respected. You recognized that the great poet and the great scholar in China was an honored individual. He was a superior kind of person. Therefore, there was much inducement to share in the honors, recognition which he received. No discussion of being better. Simply the process of naturally growing. Not trying to lift some part of your nature, not saying I will control my temper if it kills me, or it probably will kill you, but rather I will write great poetry, I will love good books, I will walk out in nature and enjoy the sunset, I will enjoy good things and beautiful things, and I will like to be with people who are by nature noble and virtuous and honorable. So by degrees, Confucius, as he explains it, lifts the total nature. He doesn't make one part of the mind stronger than another. He simply lifts all of the consciousness until the individual becomes a little ashamed to do things that are not consistent with his new appreciations, his new values. He finds it a little more difficult to be dishonest if he truly loves beauty. He finds it a little more difficult to be unpleasant if he really wishes to be regarded as an admirable person. And by degrees, he grows. He overcomes these negative qualities simply by inviting himself to a larger understanding of life. He simply does the things more and more adequately, which he has a desire to do. Confucius talked to his disciples, or those who came to study with him, and he found that even those of comparatively mediocre personal attainments had certain desires, certain hopes, certain things which they desired mostly to accomplish. One of them wished to be a good horseman. And this was what was emphasized. Because in horsemanship came sportsmanship. And as Confucius pointed out, a man who is a good horseman respects his horse. And a man who respects his horse will respect another man. Gradually also good sportsmanship came in. And the man who believes that the best rider should win the race will also believe that the best thinker should have the office. He will also believe that merits become more important. He will not be envious of those who succeed, but will rather try to fit himself to succeed because he understands the principle of good sportsmanship. Thus, in various ways, the individual raises his general attitude toward life. He raises his attitude by directing his activities toward worthwhile things. Most neurotics have no worthwhile activities. If they have any, they have overworked them or perverted them until they have lost their worthwhileness. The individual who has an activity as a desperate escape from something will never function normally. He will destroy the very remedy which could help him. If, however, having certain restrictions or limitations or problems within his own nature, he seeks a broad, deep compensation through properly selected activity, he will find that by gentle direction, he can lead his life into more profitable channels. Thus, he can work with the powers and principles that he has. As he goes on, depending more and more upon qualitative value within himself, philosophy will no longer be a long and difficult word that he is afraid of. He will reach for it and reach for true religion because he has gradually built within himself the kind of consciousness that needs these things. They will no longer be forced upon him as therapy. He will instinctively and inevitably choose them. As his own nature, under a certain broad directive, is given an opportunity to unfold according to its own laws and principles. Health is the natural state of the body. Normalcy is the natural state of the mind. And this state is most easily restored and most quickly restored by permitting normalcy, by gradually causing the nature to direct itself more and more toward normal expression. A gentle leadership toward normalcy is much better than a violent correction. The individual will discover that he can, in most cases, solve his problem. That his subconscious mind is not going to continue to betray him unless he continues to feed it. If he continues to pour mystery into it, if he is surrounded by circumstances which he regards as dishonest, if he continues to see himself as a victim of this or that, if he lives in a universe which is not rational, and material science takes rationality away from the universe, if he feels himself the pawn of accident, or the helpless victim of outrageous providence, if these emotions are within him, he will be sick. He cannot help it. He will regard his condition as hopeless, and will dissolve in his own doubts and depression. Therefore, he has to gradually work through an active philosophy of life. He has to recognize that without rational directives, without convictions that are stronger than circumstances, he can never be truly healthy. Now, a great question has arisen in psychology, and it's being argued all the time, that man may, in his search for some spiritual integrities upon which to build a foundation for life, fall into superstition. That some of the things that he believes may not be ultimately true. That his faith may be wasted on something that is not worthy of his faith. I do not think that this is nearly as important as we make it sound. I don't think the ultimate integrity or validity of a belief is its primary value. We know we live in a relative world, but man is internally incapable of an absolute knowledge of value. Therefore, it is quite possible that what he believes today must be reformed tomorrow. But this does not mean that a belief is not valuable. If a belief is basically beautiful, if it is basically constructive, if it impels the individual to that kind of conduct which restores normalcy and makes him a better citizen, then I think Lord Bacon was correct when he stated that there is no superstition worse than believing that everything is superstition, and that it is far better to believe all the fables of the Koran and all the mysterious stories of the Talmud than to believe that this universal fabric is without a soul. In other words, we must nearly always believe something. When we believe something bad, we are neurotic. When we believe something good, we are no longer neurotic. We have courage, we have values, we have expressions, we have confidence. And in these strengths, we find the possibility of more adequate and more normal personal function. So I believe that the answer to a large number of these questions that psychologists have been working with lies in the reorientation of the total person, educationally, philosophically, scientifically, religiously. A reorientation in which a new standard of value is made available to the individual. Nothing in the form of our material dilemma can be solved without a better standard of value than we have now. And if we are going to solve world problems, we must use the same instrument that we would use in solving individual problems. We are sick when our standard of value is not strong enough and not high enough. We are well when our standard of value is bigger than ourselves and continually challenges us to grow and to become more than we are at any particular given time. So the ventilation of our subconsciousness can in many ways be affected by a mystical equation. The ancient peoples had the realization that you could re-indoctrinate this internal part of yourself. The meditative disciplines, various sacred arts and sciences of ancient peoples and Eastern nations, by means of which certain internal life was strengthened. These disciplines certainly were calculated to make a distinct change in the subconscious life of the individual. Self-discipline and spiritual or sacred exercises and rituals also affect this subconscious pattern. They set themselves in it just as excesses and mistakes have set themselves in it. They strengthen the internal life, and it is quite possible that there is a wonderful power by means of which man is capable of completely redeeming and regenerating his own internal life. Perhaps this is the alchemistical transmutation of base metals. Man does not have to go on being a neurotic indefinitely, nor does he have to depend upon a mechanical formula which may or may not actually meet his needs. Neurosis is a challenge. The moment the individual is unhappy, there is something wrong with his mental and emotional life, just as surely as the moment he is sick, there is something wrong with his physical habits or his physical economy. Unhappiness is a symptom. It is a symptom of being wrong in something. No one can be miserable and right. No one can be correct and be in trouble all the time. Consequently, we must accept unhappiness or disunity of our inner lives, lack of peace of mind and peace of soul. We must accept these obvious weaknesses as indications of sickness within the psychic life. Perhaps the sickness is not dangerous or deadly, but it is present if we are not at peace with ourselves. So again, as we have noted before, this comes into rather violent contrast with our modern thinking. We are more or less taught today that irritation, frustration, neurosis, these things make better people. That we must have a big fight on our hands all the time. In order to spur us on to what? To the hypothetical achievements of the future. I heard someone not long ago point out that if it was not for this tremendous dissatisfaction, this desperate struggle to be what we are not, the whole race would go to pieces. Well, if we struggle much more, we would go to pieces anyway. We're not going to achieve the end that we want. It depends on what we want. If we want a competitive civilization that is going to go on and on and on, becoming more difficult, more expensive, and more frightening through the ages, until scientifically we involve ourselves in some fantasy more incredible than modern scientific fantasy fiction, if we just want to go on struggling for unknowns and perhaps hazarding our own survival, we can do so. But that we should assume that the continuation of misery is the justification for living is basically wrong. It's based upon the idea we've always been uncomfortable and therefore we might as well get used to it. We have today in the United States more than 1 million persons mentally sick. But there's no use telling these people to get used to it. Nor is there any use in telling them that they are splendid martyrs on the field of progress. There is no use telling them that they may never be well again, but that 1,000 years from now we will reach another planet in a steel projectile because of the tremendous kind of stress that wrecked them. This type of thinking is absolutely invalid, and yet it's the kind of thinking that is dominating too many people's minds today. Actually, any form of psychology, any form of sociology, any form of so-called progress, which is essentially detrimental to vast numbers of persons, or detrimental to one sensitive human soul, cannot be right. It is simply that we accept these things because we've never known anything else. Now, we must face some such a situation as this, and we must also, if we believe, as we do believe, in the presence of justice, in the presence of universal good, reality, truth, in the existence of a sovereign purpose and plan behind all things, if we believe in principles that are real and valid, we must sometime recognize the importance of living what we believe. And the moment we start living these principles, because we believe them, we will find that our psychological conditions will rapidly improve. The subconscious of the individual can just as easily be a repository of good as it can be a repository of fear and doubt and anxiety. Now, how can we achieve this in terms of subconscious projection? Again, the Taoists of China have a very interesting concept, and that is the possibility of the visualization of a transcendent state of self. An individual, for example, who develops a bad complex, continues through a period of time to build up a delusion. That delusion, finally taking over the subconscious form of or nature of his being, forms a kind of entity in the psychic field. You can call it a psychological obsession, if you wish. It may not be the kind of demon that they talked about in the Middle Ages, but it certainly exercises a demoniacal force upon the person who has permitted himself to build up this psychic parasite in his own nature. If, therefore, a person can build a negative entity which can ultimately destroy him, is it not also possible that the subconscious mind of man has a purpose? That this purpose is not merely to make him suffer. That the subconscious mind of man is also the greatest potential source of growth, if he can cause it to retain certain values that are essentially right. Thus, the re-education of the subconscious can be conceived as possible. The Chinese believe that it was done by means of visualization. They believe that it was perfectly possible for the individual to internally visualize himself as he should be, visualize the values and purposes and qualities of his true life. In other words, visualize his true self. Visualize himself much in the aspect of Emerson's Oversoul. visualize himself as a divine being, a being living at peace with all things, a being dedicated to the service of good, a being existing and abiding continuously in the presence of the divine love and the divine will. That this being is a sacred and immortal self within man, the transcendent self, the God self. That this God self is also accessible to man. That this God self can be created in the subconscious just as easily as the demon self. Just as surely as the individual may gradually come under the obsession of a tyrannical part of his own subconscious, so he can come also, as the Sufi and the Dervish and other mystics have found out, come into the presence of a magnificent, illumined, internal subjective. But this subconscious life of man is also a magic garden which he builds within himself, that he transforms and transmutes his own subconscious by filling it with beauty, understanding, love, and piety. That he gradually also creates within himself an inner life in which he can live. That he builds out of this psychic nature a kind of magic garden like that of the troubadours. That here in the courts of love he can abide in a spiritual communion. His inner life, instead of being a madhouse, becomes a cathedral, a chapel, and as going into himself, he finds there peace instead of confusion. Gradually, this internal self becomes an archetype, a leader in the direction of positive growth. And the so-called subconscious mind of man then almost becomes a superconscious structure. It becomes the basis of his courage rather than of his fear. It becomes the basis of his growth rather than of his sickness. And the way in which this change is accomplished is through the establishment of the nutritional habits by which the patterns are cast into the subconscious from the conscious. If these things must come out, they must first go in. And that part of our consciousness which is due to experience moves from the outside in and then from the inside out again. If, therefore, we move from the outside in constructive and idealistic value, and that takes up its repository in man, this in turn moves out once more into objectivity as a source of inspiration rather than as a source of fear or doubt or sickness or destruction. It is not, therefore, necessary to assume that this subconscious must always be burdened with difficulty. Now, the problem of the subconscious brings with it another equation, and that is the possibility of the existence of a collective subconscious. Namely, that there is in the universe itself a stratum which corresponds with each of the individualized functions or powers of man. It may therefore follow that if there is a conscious mind in man, that this conscious mind is derived from part of the conscious mind of the world. If there is a subconscious mind in man, that this also reflects or reveals in some ways the subconscious mind of all nature. And that from this subconscious mind of nature, man receives impressions or impulses from archetypes, or from the great plans and patterns of life. Let us then assume what we have to assume, namely that man's mind, conscious, superconscious, subconscious, unconscious, whatever department we wish to consider, that this mind is not primary but secondary, and that behind this mind is something else, which we might term consciousness, or perhaps more correctly, being. Certainly Buddhism would not permit it to be regarded as consciousness as we know it, but rather a state of inevitable and eternal existence. If then there be a source in man, or by means of which man is brought into awareness with natural cause, with archetype, with divine purpose, or the oversoul of nature, as may be implied from archetypal dreams and archetypal experiences of one kind or another, then it would appear, as Dr. Jung points out, that this subconscious mind is like a deep pool, and that occasionally something will break off at the bottom of the pool and gradually float to the surface, and that the pressures or circumstances or forces long and deeply hidden may come up gradually to our awareness from deep sources previously unsuspected. Therefore, we can assume, if we wish to, or at least suspect, that there might be something in the subconscious content of man other than merely the consequences of his own mentation. Assuming that there is a strata that is really a constant circle, vicious or otherwise, of his own mental psychic operations, perhaps there is something else. Perhaps the lower, deeper, and innermost parts of the subconscious are in some way connected with or associated with a still deeper and more recondite level of natural existence. Perhaps there is a divine will or a divine plan that impresses itself upon the deeper parts of man's consciousness, particularly the subconscious or unconscious parts of the psyche, and by so doing gives man an awareness of spiritual extension or an awareness of cause beyond his normal human capacity. We cannot say that this is not true. We can say that there are instances beyond question of doubt in which something superior to the purpose of the individual was impressed upon him through archetypal dreams. We may assume, of course, that this superior thing is a part of his own nature, a higher and a more divine part, which he perhaps never contacts except through the phenomena of the subconscious or unconscious mind. Perhaps only in archetypal dreams does the will of his own total being become known to him symbolically, emblematically, or figuratively. This is conceivable, but perhaps does not essentially change the major pattern with which we are concerned. This pattern has to do with the general perspective which we have toward life itself. Let us assume for a moment that the subconscious or inner part of ourselves, below and behind the threshold of consciousness as we daily exhibit it, is older, deeper, and in many ways more valid than consciousness. That consciousness is merely a manifestation, a small part of this deeper thing coming to the surface of our awareness, and that for every moment of consciousness, man has a tremendous power of unconsciousness, which is not vacuum, which is not absence, which is not darkness or negation, but a state of a spiritual existence below the threshold of our definition, something that we cannot immediately cognize. If then such is the case, there is every possible reason to suspect that the so-called unconscious or subconscious may have tremendous values. Supposing the great conflict that we have today is due to the fact that man objectively is violating certain principles and laws of his own subconscious. Supposing man as a subconscious being rooted in nature and law, deriving certain inner counsel or inspiration from higher levels of interior recognition. Suppose this conflict is between what man internally knows to be right and the frustration of a program or pattern which he consciously accepts but which subconsciously he cannot accept. Is it possible that our trouble today is that our external life is simply not acceptable to our internal understanding? That we are gradually divorcing ourselves more and more completely from our own internal? That actually, with this procedure which we call living today, this entire total expanse of life with which we are familiar, has nothing in common with the essential purpose of consciousness? We may pretty well assume that this is so. The reason why we may assume that this is so is because we are aware that the motions of consciousness are not identical with the motions of thought, and there is no reason to assume that there is a dependency of one upon the other. If man has an existence as a spiritual being, if he has an existence as a unit within the total consciousness of a universal being, if man has any consciousness superior to that of the material sphere in which he exists, then this material sphere and its concerns must be comparatively meaningless to that superior consciousness. The only possible and reasonable relationship between them is that man is here for the purpose of certain experience growth. That the individual exists in the dream only in order that he may be impelled to awaken from that dream. That nothing that relates to an eternal existence can be justified or satisfied by present levels of conduct, except the implication of essential growth itself. The only thing that man can really do in this world that is important is become better. The only thing he can do with this world that will help him is to gradually and magnificently outgrow its limitations. By becoming better, we do not necessarily mean egocentrically searching out its own salvation, but through whatever activity, through service, through even martyrdom, through the greatest impersonality and detachment, but by whatever virtue appears to us to be most virtuous, man fulfills himself in this world only by the fact of becoming a better being. All other values relating to this world are at best indirect attainments. They do not contribute to the principal motion of man. For the last several thousand years, not long ago, just a few days ago, I was making quite a survey of the history of the Ottoman Empire and its effect upon the rise of North African and Near Eastern culture. It's quite a book, quite a study. And one of the things that you learn almost from the beginning, and you never have to unlearn anywhere during the procedure, is that you are going to be confronted with an endless pageantry of human selfishness, stupidity, greed, lust, and pillage. And you're not disappointed. A good sultanate or a good caliphate in that particular period was an island of grace in an ocean of blood. There were only a very few really outstanding benevolent persons. Yet all these persons who lived and suffered and died, who conspired to destroy each other, who aspired to some small gain, who lived by making life unbearable to others. All these have come and gone, and they are the story of man, the story of this tremendous uselessness, this tremendous waste of energy, this constant emphasis upon selfishness in a world in which selfishness can never win anything except a magnificent mausoleum. If man internally knows this, and if he has any consciousness superior to his objective consciousness, he must know it. If man knows this, there in itself is a magnificent reason for a wholesale neurosis. The only answer that can protect man from neurosis under such reasoning is a still deeper reasoning, by means of which he discovers that all of this terrible travesty, this incredible disaster, as our human mind and thought interprets it, is a necessary part of an essential growth. We cannot but remember the thinking and the wonderful words of Vyasa in certain sections of the Mahabharata, where he explains how all of these phantoms of life and death, the phantoms of killing and being killed, are all strange dreams and illusions. That out of the entire mystery of life comes the final realization that nothing is lost, nothing dies, nothing actually fails. This tremendous internal insight must also lurk somewhere in the rudimentary basic parts of man's consciousness. For without such basic instincts, he could scarcely survive the tragic weight of his own errors. Somewhere, all of this is locked in man's mind, or it could not come out through the voices of the poets, through the great religious revelations, through the magnificent philosophies that have led the world. Men know these things, but they are not able as yet, apparently, to organize this knowledge into a program of personal conduct. Yet today we are training people, thousands of them, to be counselors, to be psychologists, to take the places of the old counselors that men knew. And instead of going to the family minister or the family doctor or the village judge, we now go to the counselor. We go to him primarily to get over a trouble that presently burdens us. But we cannot get over this trouble merely on a mechanical, physical, materialistic formula. This trouble is deeper than this. This trouble goes to the very root of our own consciousness. This trouble goes into the frustration of the individual who is not able to grow and be himself, perhaps does not even know how to grow. So a complete and total reorganization of our educational outlook and our approach toward life, an education based upon an idealistic foundation, is the only adequate solution to our problem. We can never limit man. We can never make him sufficiently physical so that he will forget that behind this physical being there's something else. There's something that is starving and dying for expression and release. And this struggle between our subconscious pressures and our conscious living may be quite different from what we have generally presumed that it is or assumed it to be. But this conflict goes into the deepest stratum in which is locked, perhaps, the only real knowledge we have, the knowledge of our own purpose and destiny, which is not consciously available to us but is unconsciously present as an equation. It is this unconscious equation that makes us forever dissatisfied, makes us forever like the story of the pilgrim in the hymn of the Robe of Glory, ever seeking something greater, something nobler, and like Odysseus returning from the Trojan War, forever sailing in quest of our own native land from which we have departed. This search for home, this search for spiritual value is always a search within. And this search within now takes us to the threshold of an infirmity. And perhaps this infirmity tells us most clearly what is wrong with us. Because it shows us that we are so living on the outside that the inside of the cup is not clean. It shows us that instead of being able to turn into ourselves as we would enter into a place of worship, we go into ourselves as into a strange sickness and must seek to escape from ourselves constantly in order to escape from this sickness. Man, the noblest creature, with this tremendous potential that he possesses, is actually afraid to search inside of himself. He's afraid to let down the bonds and barriers which he has built, loose the torrents of his own internal dissatisfaction. He is unable to curb or check the measure of the sorrows and pains and pressures that are within him. This should not be. And psychology should be among the first groups to work with this particular equation. I rather like the thinking of a psychological standpoint on this of some of the early Buddhist doctrines, where I feel that in many respects the Buddhists and Vedantists are very close to the true answer to the entire mystery. We wonder sometimes why nearly all religious and philosophical groups of antiquity and even of the modern world have recommended a kind of asceticism. We wonder why they advocated that their disciples depart from worldliness and seek quietude in the deserts or in monastic orders or in convents or places of seclusion. This idea of giving up the world, I think what they were striving after was to release the sensory life of man, which is locked so tightly upon objectives.
As long as man thinks, lives, and feels in terms only of things around him, he will never escape from the vicious fixation in which he is captured. He is going to constantly be the victim of this vicious circle. He will never be able to turn with relaxation to himself. And he will never be able to enter into himself and find there anything that is pleasing to him, while his inner life is loaded only with the reactions of his physical intensities. Most of your great mystical teachings, your Sufis, Dervishes, Druzes, many other sects, have emphasized that as man relaxed the pressures of externals, he at the same time became capable of living with himself. The moment he was not fighting things on the outside, the spirit of war died in him. The moment he was not under the pressures of jealousy and greed and fear and doubt and worry, when these things ceased, his inner life became immediately more placid. Quietude, then, came from the relaxing away from the intensities of personal attachments and interpretations. In our Western way of life, these intensities are increasing every day. And attachments, of course, can be those of negative fear. I've received a half a dozen letters in the last 3 months of individuals in a state of complete terror over the possibility of atomic warfare. These people are frightened to death. They are not going to wait to die naturally or supernaturally from the bomb. They're going to kill themselves in the meantime. They are completely terrified at the possibility of the destruction of themselves by this form of warfare. Yet these same persons are comparatively indifferent to the fact that if there is no bomb at all, they will also destroy themselves. Bomb or no bomb, they're going to be in trouble. Because the fear they have of the bomb is merely a redirection of a fear that they have previously had in everything. Fear will destroy them, not the thing which they fear. And while an individual fears, he is never sure of life, and he is never able to release his own internal into a state of security. It is quite possible that the individual may sometime be faced with great physical crisis. But if he is, all the more reason why he must have his internal resources intact with which to face it. Fear will never accomplish this. Yet persons who do not live well are afraid to die. Yet these persons may be committing suicide with their own thoughts. But because they are thinking the way they want to, this suicide is a perfectly acceptable prospect. All this must change if we are ever going to solve anything. And the way in which it must change is that the individual will either be forced by nature and perhaps through the very instrumentation of something like the atomic bomb, or by some other factor, man will be required by nature to break away from his unhealthy over-addiction to phenomena. He will be shown by nature that he cannot invest his happiness all in external things. He cannot depend for his existence upon success, as he calls it. He cannot be satisfied only by those things which belong to his own external life. As long as he is willing to trust himself to the fate of externals, he will rise and fall with these externals. He will be impoverished every time the stocks go down. He will have a momentary flurry of exaltation every time they go up. But whether they rise or fall, he will ultimately destroy himself, or he will pass out of this life impoverished because his mind has been on the wrong things. Psychology should teach us to reintegrate around standards of essential value, to teach us that once we have integrated our inner lives, we can then administer any external thing with reasonable security. It is not that man has to give away everything he owns and become a mendicant. It is that the individual must have value within his own nature. And having attained integration, integrity in himself, he can use all the privileges of living without abusing them. He can solve the problems of material society because he has integrated himself. But without this internal integration, he cannot survive any of the shocks or stresses which naturally come to him. Consequently, it is possible, in fact, very reasonable to assume that man's subconscious mind, which has been plaguing him, is also a plastic substance, which, if it is properly molded, will be the heroic shape of strength within himself. That which is the theodemon is also composed of the same substance as the hero of the world. Man's heroic self can also be internally visualized, built, strengthened by an understanding of the laws governing the power of mind and memory. The subconscious, therefore, can be gradually transformed into the powerful directive which, moving out into his external life, will put it in order. When the subconscious mind is as strong in virtues as it is now strong in pressures, the individual will live a healthy physical life. Integrities are without pressure. Pressures are without integrity. We cannot have both. As long as we are moved from pressures, there is something wrong. We are moved without knowledge. Education, in the true sense of the word, removes pressure. Any individual who is pressureful is ignorant, regardless of how much he knows in terms of schooling. Pressure is chaos within self. And this means that the person has not integrated his own cosmos. He is not master of his world or master of the sphere of life in which he exists. All these things tell us, as the Zenshu points out, that man's mind is performing tricks on him. The mind is indeed the possible slayer of the real. The mind is indeed one of the most subtle of all instruments. It is part of the power that still works for good while ever scheming ill, as Mephisto says in Faust. The mind of man is a wonderful servant and a horrible master. The individual who gradually gains achievement or victory over the various doubts of his own intellect will find mind a wonderful instrument for the accumulation of experience. But until this mind is honest, until it accepts experience without distortion, until it records facts without prejudice, until it escapes from bondage to ignorant superstition and fear, until it is honorable in its registering of values, and there's no longer merely catering to the weaknesses and insecurities and immaturities of human life nature. Only when it is mature can it serve man. Now, the maturity of the outer mind is not possible. Maturity does not lie in the objective consciousness of man, because this consciousness simply records. This consciousness is now. This consciousness is the kind which gives us the records and evidence of immediate happenings. The present consciousness of man deals with news, as the press tells us. The subconsciousness of man deals with history. And the difference between news and history is rather obvious. All news is gradually becoming history. All history has become news in some time or other. But the important thing is that history is a pattern. It is a consecutive record of news. It is news made moral by reflection. It is news made spiritual by the revelation of the effect of cause and the cause of effect. It is news, therefore, brought into something that can be philosophically examined for the purpose of contributing to the well-being of the individual now. If Adolf Hitler had really studied history, he would never have permitted himself to be a dictator. It is news that the conscious mind records. In the subconscious, this news becomes history. It becomes the basis of philosophy. It becomes the basis of contemplation and reflection. In the subconscious, we have the records of the consequences of things we have done. And we are constantly being plagued by the proof that negative attitudes can only destroy. We have therefore much to learn from it, much to gain from it, if we use it wisely. But if we continue to drift in our old accustomed ways, permitting ourselves whatever excess of thinking may come along at the moment, and then run merely to the mental physician in time of emergency, we will be in almost continual emergency. We have, to a large degree, conquered the ailments of the body. There are a few that still must be conquered, but we are beginning to suspect that those that have not been conquered belong to the sphere of the mind, and that is the reason we have not previously been able to conquer them physically. We believe that many ailments, difficult to diagnose, difficult to prescribe for, are actually psychologically founded within the conscious life of the individual. In any event, we are gradually going to work out diagnosis and therapy on the level of mind. We are going to gradually be able to take care of certain problems of the mind with more efficiency, more understanding, more wisdom than ever before. But just as surely as we do this, we are going to develop a new group of ailments. They are not going to be physical, and they're not going to be mental. They're going to relate to something else. They're going to relate primarily to the interval between man's conduct and the universal law in which he exists. There's going to be finally a group of ailments that will be corrected by only one thing, and that is man's voluntary obedience to the divine plan of which he is a part. Also, man's voluntary dedication to self-education until he knows what that plan is. He is going to find that the end of religion is to obey the law. He is going to find that the end of science is to find out how to obey the law completely and efficiently. And that the end of philosophy is to discover the rationale by means of which it becomes evident to all thoughtful persons that obeying the law is the greater good. All of these processes mean that first we must obey the laws of the body to be healthy physically. Then we must obey the laws of the mind to be healthy mentally and psychologically. Then we must obey the laws of the infinite, which is beyond these other factors, in order that we may have total adjustment with consciousness. Now, it might seem that these laws of the infinite are a long way off and represent a further state of development far from our present condition. But these three steps are present every day in our lives. Each one of us must obey certain physical laws now in order to remain healthy, and obey certain other physical laws, such as those of traffic, if we wish to remain alive. We must also obey certain psychological laws. We must obey those laws which have to deal with certain repressions, certain frustrations, certain inhibitions. If we do not permit ourselves, for example, to get rid of our grudges, get rid of our animosities, and begin to hold some rather kindly, pleasant, and constructive thoughts about things, very rapidly we get so sick we cannot endure ourselves. There are laws here that we have to obey now. There are also spiritual laws which we also have to obey now. And those laws have to do with the great basic motivations of why we do anything. We should not obey physical laws merely in order to stay well, nor should we obey psychological laws merely in order to stay sane. It is our privilege and our magnificent opportunity through our understanding to obey all laws for one value beyond all of this. Namely, that these laws reside in the love and wisdom of God, and that to obey universal law is to prove that we love and respect God, and that we do these things not for fear of punishment, nor hope of reward, but because it is natural and proper for the human being to worship the Creator and the great creating power of life in which he exists through the simple obedience to the will of that Creator, who tells us through his revealed saints and prophets, if you love me, keep my commandments. And this is the basis of health, that we are good and are wise and are noble, not because we primarily wish to be healthy, but because we wish to be right, because we wish to worship truly the creating power of life. And if out of this power and determination to worship, if out of the natural love of God we do all things well, then whatever other needs we have, psychologically, emotionally, and physically, will naturally move to their own solution. If we search first for the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, all other things shall be added unto us. And if when from right motive we keep the rules of life, we shall then, as a byproduct of this right motive, enjoy health, happiness, and peace of soul. These are the things we should be learning. These are the things our teachers should be telling us. Because this is the way which not only leads to our own security, but to world peace, the brotherhood of man, and all the good things that need doing.